and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Senator McConnell, who is blocking police reform, tax reform, immigration reform, voting rights, economic stimulus, and the January 6th Commission, and is now vowing not to cooperate on raising the debt ceiling ahead of the September 30 deadline, even after entreaties from former Republican Secretaries of the Treasury, Paulson and Mnuchin. Joining us is James Galbraith, Chair in Government Business Relations and a professor at the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin, who served in several positions on the staff of the U.S. Congress. The author of Inequality, What Everyone Needs to Know, and most recently, Welcome to the Poison Chalice, The Destruction of Greece and the Future of Europe. We will discuss the brinkmanship underway with the normally uncontroversial and bipartisan raising of the debt ceiling that changed under Gingrich in the 1990s and has been a weapon of choice for the Republicans, even though at the end of the day, it's usually found to be bluff and bluster. Then we'll look into the resignation of the U.S. envoy to Haiti, Ambassador Foote, whose letter protesting what he calls the inhumane treatment of Haitian refugees on the Texas border with Mexico has the White House and the State Department on the defensive. Joining us is Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Gary Pierre-Pierre, who left the New York Times in 1999 to launch the Haitian Times, a New York-based English-language weekly publication serving the Haitian diaspora. We'll discuss how Haiti's problems have come to the U.S., and it is time for the U.S. to get serious about helping the poorest country in the hemisphere. Then finally, we will speak with Sarah Turberville, the director of the Constitution Project at the Project on Government Oversight, where she coordinates public education and advocacy efforts on matters relating to habeas corpus, surveillance, and immigration. She has an op-ed at the Los Angeles Times, Abusing Migrants While on Horseback. That fits the Border Patrol's long history of brutality, and we will discuss why the Border Patrol was singled out as America's most out-of-control law enforcement agency. And before we go to our first guest, while Background Briefing remains a nationally syndicated radio program with a growing national and international audience, we are relying more and more on our online and podcast audience to sustain us for as little as $5 a month to keep this program alive during the critical years ahead in which the fate of American democracy will be decided. For those of you who can, help us keep delivering a daily briefing so those not in a position to contribute at backgroundbriefing.org/donate can also join in the fight against disinformation, whether it comes from Mar-a-Lago or Moscow. We must win the political warfare battles underway and fight with weaponized facts to save our democracy as we create a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now is James Galbraith, Chair of Government Business Relations and a professor at the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin. Having served in several positions on the staff of the U.S. Congress, he directs the University of Texas Inequality Project and is an advisor to the Democracy in Europe Movement 2025. And his books include Inequality, From What Everyone Needs to Know, and most recently, Welcome to the Poison Chalice, The Destruction of Greece and the Future of Europe. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Galbraith.
Thanks. It's good to be with you again.
Well, thanks for joining us. And should we be alarmed about what's happening now with the Republicans in the Senate, Mitch McConnell, refusing to raise the debt ceiling by September the 30th? I know there's a lot of brinksmanship involved, and that essentially began in the 1990s with Newt Gingrich. Prior to that, raising the debt ceiling was not a problem, and there was a bipartisan agreement to do it. But then Gingrich brought the brinkmanship in to trying to force Clinton to cut Social Security. It didn't work. But ever since then, it's become a tool of brinksmanship. So should we be alarmed, or is this just posturing?
Well, this is such an old comedy that I don't even need to revise my lines from the last time it was staged. The reality is that the debt ceiling, which was an exercise in bad faith on the day it was first enacted, which was at the start of the First World War for the U.S. in 1917, has and always has been a simple exercise in bad faith political posturing, with a lot of gloom and doom and scare scenarios that are come out of both sides, because it serves the interests of those who would like to see it raised and those who want to use it as leverage to exaggerate the importance of this particular piece of legislation. But, you know, the reality is that it is not an important piece of legislation, and it's basically the whole exercise is in kabuki theater and nothing more than that. We have real problems, but a failure to raise the debt ceiling is the least of them.
So why then did the former Secretaries of the Treasury, the Republicans, Paulson and Mnuchin, weigh in with McConnell and warn him against this? Why did they do that if it's all theater?
Well, they're playing their roles in the theatrical production, of course. You know, it'd be a good thing to get this, to repeal the debt ceiling altogether rather than that go through this exercise. But you have to consider what people are saying. If the debt ceiling was not raised, what would happen? Would the Treasury stop paying Social Security or other commitments? No, it would still have a legal commitment to pay them, and those checks would continue to go out. The last time this issue was in the news, we looked into it and realized that the Treasury doesn't even have the software that would be required to stop payment on its legally contracted checks. So from that point of view, and people who are afraid of that sort of thing can turn over and go back to sleep. In terms of the financial markets, well, of course, it's possible that some people would sell assets in the event of an expiration of the debt ceiling. You could see a dip in the markets. But other people would come in and buy those assets, recognizing that the whole thing is very short-term and temporary, and everything would go back to the previous valuations just as soon as the issue was resolved or as soon as people realized that nothing much was going to happen. So I'm absolutely not in the doom and gloom camp, but then on the other hand, I'm a bystander in the drama. I'm only watching it for the, you know, for the entertainment value, essentially.
So in terms of just to get a reality check here, so is what's going on essentially that McConnell wants to tie the debt ceiling to this $3.5 trillion package and basically deny the Democrats any kind of Republican buy-in to raise the debt ceiling so that he can then demagogue and say, oh, look at the reckless Democrats. They're spending $3.5 trillion and they're raising the debt ceiling in order to spend the $3.5 trillion, ignoring the fact that under Trump, the deficit went up by $8 trillion and the Republicans were perfectly happy to sign on to the massive tax cuts for the rich.
Well, under Trump, we got a massive rescue package in the face of the pandemic, when they don't want to they want to put Biden in as many political difficulties as possible running up to the next round of midterm elections. That's their agenda, of course. That's their agenda. And as I say, it serves everybody's interest to exaggerate the importance of this particular, you know, teapot tempest. But, you know, if there were a serious threat to the economy, you can be absolutely confident that the issue will be resolved by some theatrical device before the vote is taken. And I suspect that will happen even though there's not really such a threat, because nobody wants to, you know, have the curtain lifted and reveal that, you know, behind the curtain there's another, just the, you know, the Wizard of Oz mumbling into a microphone. You just, what would happen if you actually allowed the debt ceiling to expire and you woke up the next day and the sun was rising and people were still at work and the stock market, well, may have taken a little dip but it's quickly recovering, and everybody would say, what was all that about?
And again, I'm speaking with James Galbraith, Chair of Government Business Relations and a professor at the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin. Having served in several positions on the staff of the U.S. Congress, he directs the University of Texas's Inequality Project and is an advisor to the Democracy in Europe Movement 2025. And his books include Inequality, What Everyone Needs to Know, and most recently, Welcome to the Poison Chalice, The Destruction of Greece and the Future of Europe. But the calendar, of course, in the Senate is very key. And my understanding is that the Democrats would have to pass the debt ceiling via reconciliation. And that takes time away from the crammed calendar to stop the Republicans' massive voter suppression plans underway and being enacted, in fact. And, of course, the stimulus, the $3.5 trillion. So
Could the Democrats combine raising the debt ceiling with a budget reconciliation vote on the $3.5 trillion or whatever they come up with?
I don't know the answer to that. You would require an expert in Senate procedure. But your point, I think that it may be part of the Republican strategy to inject this issue in order to gum up the works as the Democrats move toward the reconciliation package. Seems to me a very plausible proposition.
But could that fact that they are trying to gum up the works motivate the Democrats to start cooperating and get something done, because they're running out of time?
Again, I don't know the answer to that. It's been a long time since I've been closely involved in congressional legislative strategy.
Right. Well, it would seem, though, that there is a problem here between progressive Democrats and moderate Democrats over the spending, and there are these rival bills, and again, the clock is ticking. I think it's on the 27th that one way or other the Democrats in the House have to vote on whether or not to go ahead with the already voted on Senate bill, the bipartisan bill. They're saying, no, we want to vote on the $3.5 trillion first. What's your sense of those games being played, and whether or not I can't believe that the Democratic Party, with its slim majority, has suicidal tendencies? Don't they have to get something done here? The fate of their re-election and the fate of Biden's presidency hangs in the balance, doesn't it?
Well, let's just say that we can hope that the Democrats come together and pass a serious and solid bill. If they don't, then it's they will be handing the Republicans a very powerful argument for the midterm elections. It's always been the case that that the voters tend to prefer real Republicans to those who are merely who are parading under false colors. But, at this point, all I can say from the outside is wait and see. There are, again, I've been inside and it's very, very difficult for an outsider to make a sensible statement, so I'll refrain from making any.
Right, but in terms of the Democrats flying under false colors, already we've had three House Democrats vote against getting rid of this terrible bill that happened under George W. Bush. In other words, the Democrats were having an attempt to be able to bargain over prescription drug prices, and they were almost there, except three Democratic congresspeople voted against the idea that the government could bargain with Medicare. And that's got people on the progressive side furious. So what is the story with these kind of Democrats? I mean, why do they exist in the first place?
Well, one always has to remember that members of the House are elected by their own constituencies, not by the general opinion of the Democratic Party at large. Members of the Senate likewise are elected by their states. So every Democratic president who is advancing a progressive agenda has to deal with people for whom it's a political liability. So I don't think that's necessary this is an unfortunate fact in the Democratic Party, but it's not necessarily a sign of bad faith. There have been examples of people who, in living memory of Democratic members who played this game simply to increase their own leverage, but that's not necessarily the case. People who are being elected from constituencies that are far more conservative than the normal or the mean Democratic constituency, the average Democratic constituency, are going to have this problem, and that's what a legislative leadership is there to try and work out.
Right, but the big pharma three that are being castigated now for not allowing the government to bargain the drug companies down and make drugs cheaper and make generics more cheaper, believe it or not, they're arguing that they're concerned about the deficit, when in fact
I can't speak for these members. I don't know their statements are.
Sure, but it's the same with them.
Obviously, I share your view that the provision is a good provision and should have had complete support, but it's clear that's not the case.
Right. Well, the same is happening with Manchin on the Senate side. He's arguing that you can't spend all this money because it's bad for the deficit, when in fact the $3.5 trillion plan raises taxes on corporations and on wealthy individuals. And so these arguments aren't making a lot of sense. So one has to assume that these politicians are basically deferring to their lobbyists as opposed to their people. That's the part that puzzles me. Everybody in this country would like to have cheaper drugs, and polls indicate that the average American believes that the wealthy should pay more in taxes. So how can you get those popular
right,
positions?
That's not the sort of Congress that we have, for the reasons I've just given you, as I'm sure you know. So it's not surprising that a person like Senator Manchin has an entirely different agenda from the senators from California or other more progressive states. He's seeking to stay alive in West Virginia. That's got to be a major piece of his agenda. Now, whether he's speaking, in some sense through a deep knowledge of the economics of deficit spending, I can't vouch for that. But then I know of very few members of Congress who speak to those issues with a deep confidence in their own expertise. What they do is they advance what my father called the conventional wisdom, and that's basically all they can do. They say something else. If they took my view, they would be viewed as eccentric, even if they recognize in private that my view is the correct one. My view being, of course, that the United States can run such expenditure programs and investment programs as it chooses to do, because it controls the financing of its own government in a way that is not unique in the world, but certainly really very exceptional and a very strong position.
So I guess just in closing here and trying to get a broader picture, if you try to get progressive legislation in this country, it seems, and we can go back to when Obama had the trifecta, he had controlled the House, the Senate, and the presidency when he came in 2009, you can't get any help from the Republicans. They're dead against it. And you try to get your side united to do it, but at the end of the day, there's just a handful of Democrats who either water it down or block it. And is this the mechanism? Is this the kind of fallback position? You talk about the establishment. The establishment wins, doesn't it? The status quo always wins.
If you look at this through the perspective of the long sweep of history, the major progressive moments occur in bursts. So 1933 was such a moment. Roosevelt had overwhelming majorities in both houses of Congress. 1965 was another such moment. Lyndon Johnson had similar vast majorities and took advantage of them. Obama had a significant advantage in 2009 that he did not use. And that was partly because his administration simply didn't have was internally divided and dominated by people who were of conventional view and lacked the imagination that was required. That was a very unfortunate missed opportunity. What's going on now, of course, is that you have a relatively progressive administration on these matters. It's really attempting to do things, but in a very, very narrowly divided Congress. They just slipped into a Democratic leadership in the Senate by the results of the senatorial elections in Georgia in 2016. It was and is a very close run thing. So I think we have to accept the fact that there's going to be intense negotiations. And that the ultimate result is not going to be it's not going to be the comprehensive victory that progressive forces might like to see. That's going to have to wait another moment when the political situation is more favorable. When that will come, I can't guarantee. For now, though, I think we can take some consolation that the administration has pressed forward on a number of issues and of making very significant advances over where we were a year ago, taking advantage of the political climate created by the pandemic and by the actions that were taken last year. That the deficit debt argument is much weaker now than it was then. And so there are things will happen that were not in the cards a year ago. But this is not Roosevelt or Lyndon Johnson's political climate, unfortunately.
Well, James Galbraith, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with James Galbraith, Chair of Government Business Relations and a professor at the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin. Having served in several positions on the staff of the U.S. Congress, he directs the University of Texas's Inequality Project and is an advisor to the Democracy in Europe Movement 2025. And his books include Inequality, What Everyone Needs to Know, and most recently, Welcome to the Poison Chalice, The Destruction of Greece and the Future of Europe.
We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the resignation of the U.S. envoy to Haiti, Ambassador Foote, whose letter protesting what he calls the inhumane treatment of Haitian refugees on the Texas border with Mexico has the White House and the State Department on the defensive.
Well, my funds are gone and the bank says no. I beg in the places where I used to pay, and I'm crazy.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Gary Pierre-Pierre, a Haitian-born Pulitzer Prize-winning multimedia and entrepreneurial journalist who left the New York Times in 1999 to launch the Haitian Times, a New York-based English-language weekly publication serving the Haitian diaspora. He's the co-founder of the City University of New York's Center for Community and Ethnic Media. Welcome to Background Briefing, Gary Pierre-Pierre.
Thank you for having me, Ian.
Well, thanks for joining us, Gary. And we last spoke, obviously, about the assassination of the former president of Haiti. That still is unresolved, and maybe we can talk about it later. But clearly, these hideous photographs of the Border Patrol agents using the reins of their horses to run down poor Haitians on the border with Mexico has upset a lot of people. It has echoes of America's dark history of slavery, etc. And a lot of Haitians, I think about 1,500, have been put onto airplanes and sent back to Haiti. Some of them don't even know they're going back to Haiti. The planes land in Port-au-Prince. They get shoved off the planes. Their possessions are just tossed onto the tarmac. And this has led the U.S. envoy in Haiti, the senior diplomat Daniel Foote, to write a letter condemning what's happening as inhumane. So what's the Haitian diaspora, what's their reaction to what's happening?
Well, there are several different reactions, Ian. First of all, thanks for having me. The first one is the outrage that everyone, including right-wing Republicans, by the way, felt this was over the top. So we all in agreement about that, that this is, you know, like you say, the dark days of American history, and this is not something that anyone should do. So we're clear on that. The other thing is about now sending these people back. Many of these people left Haiti about 10, 12 years ago. They don't have relatives in Haiti or anybody who can provide them with a shelter. And so they are, in fact, they left Haiti to help relatives there because they depended on them for their economic survival. And so right now that same person is being sent back to that family members who cannot even help itself. And so now, crazy situation, and to put it bluntly. And then, as if the story is not gut-wrenching enough, you have the president's special envoy writing a letter criticizing the administration for that situation. But hours later, the White House pushed back, and they pushed back hard. And they said that Ambassador Foote was advocating military intervention in Haiti to root out the gangs in Haiti. Now, Ian, there are a lot of things we Haitians disagree on. We disagree probably on everything. The only thing we agree on is that we don't want American or any other foreign forces in Haiti occupying it, no matter what, because the history of that is even worse than what you've seen at the border. because the last American occupation was very somewhat like you see, saw at the border, because they sent a lot of the Southern soldiers to occupy a mostly black country. And that didn't end well. And those memories are still searing in the mind of Haitians, even my generation and the one behind me. The occupation began in 1919 and it ended in 1935. So I was, my mom was a child. So I still remember, I know about this because everybody, every generation talks about the US occupation. So when you look at the situation that's going on now, this is a result of bad US policy that I think started with the occupation in 1919 and today. There's been a series of U.S.-supported coups and destabilization policy that has brought us where we are today. And where we are today, it's a bad place for everyone. The United States and the administration recognizes that, that it has, you know, inherited a terrible pickle, and it doesn't know how to get out of it so far. It has not helped Haiti, because that's why you and I keep having conversations about Haiti. Because if things were happening, I wouldn't be here talking to you if things were good. I mean, you know, and no offense to you, but I'm a journalist. I know that's how it works. And so we have a perfect storm where all of the years, decades of bad policy have come home to roost.
And in his resignation letter, Ambassador Foote said that Haiti was a collapsed state that simply cannot support the forced infusion of thousands of returned migrants lacking food, shelter, and money without additional avoidable human tragedy. And then he went on to say, which is somewhat apropos of what you're talking about, Gary, what our Haitian friends really want and need is the opportunity to chart their own course, without international puppeteering and favored candidates, but with genuine support for that course. So he's really repudiating U.S. foreign policy, isn't he?
Yes, he is, absolutely. And I kind of, obviously, I agree with him. But the thing is that the Haiti needs U.S. support. It does. But the problem is the U.S. has always defended its interests in Haiti, not Haiti's interest. And Ambassador Foote, I would say, is complicit because he's part of the system. He has been. He's a career diplomat. And he knows what has happened. And he knows what was going to happen, because at the same time we're talking about all of this, the U.S. is pushing for elections in Haiti, where you have a million people homeless, a gang situation where people can't go out, a cholera epidemic. And then you're saying that this country must hold elections soon. I mean, how in the world can you have a semblance of a free and fair election under these circumstances? They refuse to support the obvious, you know, have a caretaker government and help that government. At the same time, help build some of basic institutions in civil society that can shore up that election, that so-called democracy, because without civil society, you don't have a democracy. And right now, civil society is in tatters, like most other institutions in the country. And we don't want to build institutions, I understand that. But at the same time, you have no choice, because you have crossed the Rubicon right now. You're all in, you can't go back. And if you want to just do it halfway, as you have done in the past, then you're going to have the same result, because you have to go all in. You have to own it. I'm not saying come in and be invaded, but support it. Work with people who have the Haiti's best interests in mind. If you don't know who they are, the diaspora can help you. They want to be partner. We want to be partner, because this is our country. We were born here. We came here in search of the American dream for a better life. And many of us have achieved that. And we're at a point where we said, okay, if there's a problem, how can we help? But U.S. policy is always to keep the diaspora at arm's length, maybe out of mistrust. Maybe they don't think that we are real or true Americans, that we understand American interests. Yes, we do. We have children in school. We have jobs. We pay taxes. We do understand it. and we can help. Now, whether that help, you know, they will accept for us to help, I don't know. There's been some talk going on with USAID, Homeland Security, with some factors and sectors of the community, but it has to be more than just superficial engagement. It has to be something meaningful, as far as I'm concerned.
And again, I'm speaking with Gary Pierre-Pierre, a Haitian-born Pulitzer Prize-winning multimedia and entrepreneurial journalist who left the New York Times in 1999 to launch the Haitian Times, a New York-based English-language weekly publication serving the Haitian diaspora. He is the co-founder of the City University of New York's Center for Community and Ethnic Media. So in terms of the pushback, you're right, Gary, it's a little overheated, and obviously Ambassador Foote has really upset the White House and the State Department. The White House spokeswoman Jen Psaki responded to his letter by saying that Special Envoy Foote had ample opportunity to raise concerns about immigration during his tenure. He never once did it. And the spokesperson for the State Department, Ned Price, said, "It's unfortunate that instead of participating in a solutions-oriented policy process, Special Envoy Foote has both resigned and mischaracterized the circumstances." So I don't see how he's mischaracterized the circumstances. They're glaring us in the face, aren't they?
Yes, they are. I mean, you know, they push back. I mean, you expect that. I mean, you know, he put his neck out there, and I'm sure as a career seasoned diplomat, he knows, you know, that he expected this reaction. And so either you and I are surprised by it. But I hope that they can pivot from the political to the reality. He has raised some legitimate points, and now they need to act on them and make sure that, you know, whether or not he had raised them before, they're raised now. We all, like you said, they were staring at us in the face. So now what are they going to do about it? How are they going to approach this policy-wise? What are they going to do? We don't know. I mean, it's still early, but these are the questions that I and other journalists are asking, because you know, you can no longer hide this anymore. What happened in Del Rio, Texas, has put it out there, and so we can't pretend anymore that there isn't a problem. Now it's in America. The problem has come to America. It was always in Haiti. It was always somewhere else. It was in the Dominican Republic. It was in Mexico. Now it's in the U.S. All the good Americans, you know, they're watching it for themselves. It's not in a faraway place. It's home. It's home right now. And what are we going to do about it? Because we've been kicking that can down the street for a long time. Now we've hit the wall.
Right. And you've just to follow up on what you said earlier, which is, it makes this even more tragic. The Haitians at the border there under the bridge in Del Rio, Texas, they had to go across the Rio Grande to get food and water in Mexico because conditions were so bad there. And there are about 14,000 people. And there are others, you know, Venezuelans and others in that 14,000, but mostly Haitians. And they came largely from Brazil and other South and Central American countries, where they then made this long trek up to the U.S. and whatever savings they had. And you were saying earlier that these are the Haitians who left 10, 20 years ago and have been sending remittances back. They must have spent all of their money, and then they get tossed back into Haiti, absolutely penniless. And they were the ones that were supporting the people there in the first place. So it's a tragedy upon tragedies.
Yes, it is. And a lot of this was avoidable. It was, because Biden, you know, and it's kind of ironic in many ways, because Biden's policy towards the Haitian migrants had been quite fair. He extended a TPS designation, temporary protective status, for Haitians twice. In May, he extended it. And he said folks who were here before June were eligible. And then after the earthquake, he pushed it to July. So what happened now, Ian, is that I think there are some coyotes, or whatever you want to call them, smugglers, who convince the Haitians in Central America and South America that now it was a propitious time to get to U.S. soil, because there was a strong chance, if not a guarantee, that Biden would have had, would have extended TPS designations to them as well. I think the administration, when they saw 14,000 black, mostly black people at the border seeking entry, the only thing that came to their mind is the midterm election, how Republican is going to use that image to paint him as weak on immigration, as, you know, not being able to secure the border, as his predecessor had spent 4 years telling the country. And to them, this was what he, it was the prophecy that he was talking about. And they choose to handle it the way they did. And now they got themselves in a pickle.
So let's just quickly touch on the last couple of minutes here, Gary. I wanted to do a follow-up on our last interview just to find out what's going on in terms of the assassination of President Moïse, which is back in July. Since then, the chief prosecutor has been fired by Ariel Henry, the acting prime minister. Before that, the chief prosecutor said that he had evidence linking the acting prime minister to the assassination of President Jovenel Moïse, and that the police had issued a dozen warrants, including one for Joseph Bedeo, the former intelligence official who the prosecutor had accused of arming and directing the Colombian mercenaries, who seem pretty much like they were set up as the fall guy. So what's the latest here in the last couple of minutes?
Well, there's nothing new, but I just want to say something about that, Ian, is that if you're a chief prosecutor and you make such a, you know, claim, serious claim, you have an obligation to provide the evidence. There was no evidence besides his words. And so I'm troubled by that. And it shows you how this investigation has been politicized. And it's not serious as far as I'm concerned. It has become really a tit for tat. This was a power struggle, and I guess he lost, the prosecutor. But the tragedy is that, you know, the investigation from a Haitian official side is mired in controversy itself.
Well, just in closing, though, the bigger issue seems to be that there's so many people vying for the presidency. Now you've got the chief of the Senate, Joseph Lambert. He's wanting to run, or he's going to run. You've got the widow of Moïse. She wants to run. And I understand that the former President Martelly, whose protege Moïse was killed or assassinated, he wants to run again. And there was a falling out between Moïse and Martelly, which I don't know the extent to which that is relevant to the assassination.
Well, it's like an Agatha Christie whodunit. But one of the things I want to say, Ian, is that a Haitian presidential election usually field no less than 40 candidates. So there will be 30 others who will be vying for the presidency. As far as Martelly and Moïse is concerned, Moïse was basically a caretaker government for Martelly. That's what Martelly's idea. That's what Martelly had orchestrated. But then Moïse became, I suppose, his own man. And a lot of things Martelly wanted him to do, he wouldn't do. And they had a falling out. But I don't think that would push Martelly to assassinate Moïse. To be quite honest, my theory, and this is purely my theory, not based on my reporting, is that this assassination has very little to do with politics in terms of direct politics, real politique. This was interest being at stake, and whoever it is decided this was the course of action that person wanted to take to solve that issue. I don't think it was a political jockeying, political power struggle, no. This is, to me, based on history of Haiti, as much as I know Haiti, I've been following Haiti for 30 years as a journalist. I've studied Haitian history. As I mentioned, I know the history of the American occupation and beyond. And so we haven't had any such assassination in 100 years. And so I don't think all of a sudden we would want to go back there. And so I am convinced, based on the logic and instinct, that this had nothing to do with classic political fight.
So then what does it have to do with? Does it have to do with the powers behind the scenes feeling that Moïse was not delivering and that they could put somebody in who would deliver?
Well, not only he was not delivering, he was attacking their interests. He was taking away monopolies that they had enjoyed for over 40 years. He was taking away contracts, multi-million dollar contracts that the state had given certain different companies because he felt they were unfair. They didn't, you know, they were not in the best interest of Haiti. But the problem is that he was taking some for himself. And so I'm not here to say that he was some kind of Robin Hood. He was out in it for he was in it for himself as well. And sure. So it's complicated.
Right. Well, we'll revisit it, Gary, and thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure, Ian, anytime.
And again, I've been speaking with Gary Pierre-Pierre, a Haitian-born Pulitzer Prize-winning multimedia and entrepreneurial journalist who left the New York Times in 1999 to launch the Haitian Times, a New York-based English-language weekly publication serving the Haitian diaspora. And he's the co-founder of the City University of New York Center for Community and Ethnic Media. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back talking with the author of an op-ed at the Los Angeles Times, Abusing Migrants While on Horseback. That fits with the Border Patrol's long history of brutality. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Sarah Turberville, who is the Director of the Constitution Project at the Project on Government Oversight, where she coordinates public education and advocacy efforts on democratic institutions, the separation of powers, the protection of constitutional rights, including on matters relating to habeas corpus, surveillance, and immigration. And she has an op-ed at the Los Angeles Times, Abusing Migrants While on Horseback. That fits with the Border Patrol's long history of brutality. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sarah Turberville.
Thank you for having me.
So the optics were just hideous, and obviously the outrage is pretty pervasive and includes, of course, the Department of Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas, who said he was horrified by it, as did Vice President Kamala Harris and the White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki. But curiously enough, the U.S. Border Patrol Chief, Raul Ortiz, while they have suspended these horse patrols, he said that the long reins were used, and they looked like they were used as whips. I thought initially they actually were whips, that the long reins are used to ensure control of the horse. That doesn't seem to really address the problem.
That's very true. And in my view, that response is fitting with the Border Patrol's very long history of obfuscation when there's allegations of misconduct or abuse that are surfaced. And I think that it is incumbent on our policymakers to look at this incident not as one that's in isolation, that this is part of a pattern, that this is an agency that needs to be reined in, and that Congress has to begin to conduct some serious oversight over this agency.
And your article points out that there's just recent history, not to mention a long history. During the Obama years, children in Mexico were shot dead by agents without any acknowledgement of wrongdoing, and that the Border Patrol was singled out as America's most out-of-control law enforcement agency. It is America's largest law enforcement agency, is it not, Sarah?
Well, Customs and Border Protection is the largest law enforcement agency, and the Border Patrol is a component of Customs and Border Protection, of CBP. But it's true that it is that Border Patrol is one of the largest law enforcement agencies in the country, but it exists with some of the fewest and the sort of least amount of accountability of most agencies that exist, even at the state or local level. And part of that is because of the individuals who are often affected by abuse and misconduct, right? That these are often migrants. These are folks with fewer rights under U.S. law. They're not people with no rights, but they do have fewer rights. And then there's just the huge operational field in which they exist. And so there's certainly some logistical challenges with accountability of this agency too. But by and large, I think the problem is that Border Patrol has been very effective at stonewalling its own investigators, the Office of the Inspector General at the Department of Homeland Security, and even Congress.
But my understanding is that it expanded so much during Obama and then in particular during Trump because of all of this sense of the invasion from the South, etc. And there's no question that the Republicans have been demagoguing the border, and that to some extent explains the Biden administration's current policies. They're very vulnerable on this. It seems like the American people have, in fact, been conditioned to be fairly hostile towards immigrants coming across the southern border. But during this period when the Border Patrol, I think, has increased, I don't know, you can give me the figures if you have them, almost 100% increase in the numbers. And did the vetting break down? Did the recruiting break down? Is there something happening in that regard?
Well, that's it. That's exactly right. There's problems from sort of the bottom up, and the size of the agency just exploded after September 11th, when the Department of Homeland Security was created and Border Patrol was sort of merged into this massive new cabinet agency that now was supposed to exist primarily with an anti-terrorism function. And so, since 9/11, the country has really been looking at immigration in a totally different way than it had before. Sort of now it's this lens of, trying to protect us from the other, from potential terrorists, from potential drug smugglers, whatever it might be, rather than, kind of traditionally how immigration has been looked to in this country as how, our population has come to exist as it is. We are a country of immigrants. So the agency has increased substantially, and the recruitment and hiring practices are certainly not reflective of one that you would want to see in such a massive law enforcement agency that wields so much power. And I keep going back to the point of accountability, because I think that we would see better vetting. We would see better policies and practices when it comes to use of force, if there was actually real accountability for officers when they engage in misconduct and abuse. This is no longer a case of just a few bad apples.
And again, I'm speaking with Sarah Turberville, who is the director of the Constitution Project at the Project on Government Oversight, where she coordinates public education and advocacy efforts on democratic institutions, the separation of powers, the protection of constitutional rights, including on matters relating to habeas corpus, surveillance, and immigration. And she has an op-ed at the Los Angeles Times, Abusing Migrants While on Horseback, that fits with the Border Patrol's long history of brutality. So, Sarah, are you saying that since 9/11, with the focus on terrorism and the threat from the outside, has this become a kind of mindset where the Border Patrol agents justify their brutal behavior because they're fighting terrorists and drug smugglers and human traffickers?
I think that has been some effective rhetoric for Border Patrol. That's, the Border Patrol sort of exists in this weird space in that it operates kind of like a paramilitary organization within the United States. It's sort of part military and then it's also part police. And that confluence of factors makes it a, you know, it's sort of an especially dangerous entity within kind of traditional law enforcement for that reason. You know, Border Patrol is supposed to have a mandate to secure the borders, but also, you know, to check at the immigration status of individuals that are, you know, within the United States. But because it has a jurisdiction that allows it to operate within 100 miles of any, you know, land, air, or sea border, it means that it's not just migrants who are affected, although that, you know, that really shouldn't sort of be a distinguishing feature here. But 2/3 of Americans live in a part of the country where an agent of Border Patrol could sort of, you know, exercise powers that an ordinary law enforcement agent couldn't without some sort of reasonable suspicion of wrongdoing. And, you know, and we can talk maybe a little bit about what happened in Portland last summer, but that is another kind of way that this extraordinary jurisdiction of Customs and Border Protection has sort of been weaponized to actually be used against American citizens as well.
Well, let's talk about what happened in Portland in 2020, where the Border Patrol's tactical unit was cherry-picked. And, of course, the people that Trump had put in charge of DHS and of the Customs and Border Patrol were unqualified Trump lackeys and extremely, you know, right-wing, for the want of a better description. And these guys showed up to take on the demonstrators there, because when the Trump administration made it clear that they felt that the biggest threat to the United States was Antifa, not Black Lives Matter, which sparked the protests in the first place, the murder of George Floyd. So the fact that the Trump White House chose this unit, and they seem to be more than 100 miles away from the border with Canada, does that tell us something? That these were the people they chose, the Border Patrol's tactical unit, to come in unmarked cars, unmarked camouflage, act like the Gestapo?
I think it was a sort of almost a good sort of test case of how an agency like Customs and Border Protection could be sort of used to turn on Americans. And to me, this is sort of one of the strongest cases for why Congress really needs to rein in the jurisdiction of this agency, because, you know, Portland could very well just be a warm up for what we might be facing down the road in 2024, depending upon who ends up in the White House and has a lot of authority to, you know, dictate what's going to happen with, this agency. So, and to be clear, the agency can operate right now within 100 miles of any land, sea, or air border. So that actually, it doesn't mean that it needs to be 100 miles from Canada. It can actually be a sea border, so along the coastline. And, you know, so that's a huge swath of where Americans live in this country, and it could have been sort of almost any major city where that tactical unit from CBP could have been deployed. And, you know, there has been one member of Congress, Senator Ron Wyden, along with the junior senator from Oregon, Jeff Merkley, who has really kind of doggedly been pursuing what happened in Portland and has even held up, you know, the president of his own party's nominee to run CBP in an effort to try to get more information from DHS and DOJ about, you know, who was in Portland, what kinds of rules and regulations were they supposed to be following, what kind of coordination was there, what were the weapons used, what kind of surveillance was being conducted in the lead up to this. But Those are just two individuals. And after what we saw happen today in Del Rio, I hope that, you know, the country can, or that the Congress will use some of that outrage in a healthy way and take a hard look at an agency that has consistently engaged in misconduct, but has been very effective at rebuffing any meaningful accountability for the people that engage in that abuse.
And just to support what you've just said, the Customs and Border Patrol's own records found that it took no action in 96% of the 1,255 cases of alleged Border Patrol misconduct during January 2012 and October 2015. So just in the last couple of minutes then, Sarah, you mentioned the 2024, and assuming that you're talking about the possibility of Trump coming back, he certainly hasn't gone away. And well, obviously, Trump deployed the Border Patrol Special Tactical Unit in Portland. And writ large, if there is in fact a coup in this country, an electoral coup, because the Republicans are laying the groundwork with voter suppression, you could have some protests on a wide scale in 2024 if the Republicans steal the election, which they seem determined to do. And at this point, the Democrats seem to be pretty passive or not recognizing this fundamental threat to American democracy itself. But perhaps they will wake up when it happens in 2024, if indeed it does happen. But it's not hyperbole to suggest that it could happen. So this would be a ready-made army for Trump. Can you characterize the Border Patrol as a kind of right-wing army in waiting? Or are there decent people in it? I mean, I'm assuming.
Yeah, I wouldn't want to characterize an agency that's got 20,000, you know, agents in it. But I think that what we're talking about here is not so much the ideology of a single person, but it's the character of and the culture of the agency itself that has to be addressed in order for it not to be something that could be easily weaponized in very frightening ways in 2024, depending upon what happens with the election and what kinds of, you know, what we might be facing down the line with protests and opposition and challenges to electoral outcomes. So, you know, so I would say that there's actually some very specific things that Congress could look to do to make to bring more accountability to the agency as it exists now and to shift sort of this culture of unaccountability. And one of those things is actually to make it so that federal officials can be sued for misconduct and abuse. A federal civil rights law allows for state and local officials to be sued if they engage in the deprivation of people's constitutional and civil rights. But federal officials are held to essentially like a much lower standard, and plaintiffs that are victims of that abuse can't even get their foot in the courthouse door. And so one of the things that Congress could do is to ensure that federal officials could be sued in the same way that state and local officials could be. So there's concrete things that we can be looking to do in the next few years to try to rein in an agency like this. And I am just, you know, I pray that what happened in Del Rio is just an exercise in opening up more eyes to the reality of the persistence of misconduct of this agency.
Well, Sarah Turberville, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Sarah Turberville, who's the director of the Constitution Project at the Project on Government Oversight, where she coordinates public education and advocacy efforts on democratic institutions, the separation of powers, the protection of constitutional rights, including on matters related to habeas corpus, surveillance, and immigration. And she has an op-ed at the Los Angeles Times, Abusing Migrants While on Horseback, that fits with the Border Patrol's long history of brutality. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. If you missed any of today's program or would like to explore our vast archives, you can find us at backgroundbriefing.org, where we include extended interviews searchable by topic and have made it easy for you to sign up for daily email updates that provide links to resources, articles, and books discussed on the program. Also, you can find links there to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And we also encourage you to rate and review us on those platforms. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at Ian Masters Media. And please do help us reach more listeners by sharing this program with friends, family, and colleagues.
To help us sustain this program into the future and ensure it remains free to all, please take a moment to support us by going to backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where you will find our nonprofit Public Truth Media Foundation, where your tax-deductible donations, large and small, keep us broadcasting. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing at backgroundbriefing.org. Bye for now. The guy that lived next door in 305 took the kids to the park and disappeared by 9:30. Who will ever know how much she loved them so? That dark night alone in America. A quiet voice was singing something to me. An age-old song about the home of the brave in this land here of the free. One time, one night. One more light goes on.